Okay, I'm joined today by Ms. Connie Fogel. Ms. Fogel, thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show.
No problem. Could you start by just introducing yourself for the listeners at home and talking a little bit about the Canadian Action Party?
Okay, well, I am a lawyer by profession, although I'm no longer recently practicing because I'm devoting all my time to the work I'm doing politically. And although I'm still formally a lawyer, I'm still a member of the bar and all that sort of thing in Vancouver, British Columbia. I can still go into court, and I'm very familiar, because of my background, with done a lot of work with constitutional proceedings and political matters constitutionally, and have spent a lot of time in that area with an organization called the Defense of Canadian Liberty Committee, which brought me to the Canadian Action Party, and I've been an activist and a politically concerned person all my life, even since I was a very young teenager. So I'm just kind of that kind of a... it's just part of me to be very curious and questioning and involved in what's going on around our life and what rules us. I was also a teacher. I taught school for a number of years before I became a lawyer, and taught in various parts of Canada. Lived in Vancouver since 1970. Been very involved in local politics and federal politics throughout all that time. Canadian Action Party came into existence in 1997. I wasn't an original founder. I wasn't part of the original group, but for the very first election I did run, I was approached by people within the party because of my background. And at that time, the party was focusing almost totally on monetary reform, which is, of course, an absolute crucial something to understand about the creation and control of money, and its power is fundamental to understanding and having the capability of controlling your destiny. So I was I had to learn a lot when they came to me. There's much I didn't know in that field. I was very active in the whole anti-globalist movement, had been for a number of years. And when the leader at that time agreed to let me deal with anti-globalism issues at the same time as monetary reform issues, I said, fine, that suits me 100%. And that's how I got involved in the party. And since that time, the party has really integrated the whole connection between globalization and power and control through the money issue. So it's a party that's young. It's a party that says something nobody else will say. That's why I'm here. And it's a party that is the vehicle for the people, if they ever decide in mass to get on board to really take back control of our democracy and our country.
Okay, excellent.
Well, it's a sovereignty party.
Hmm. Okay, well, I hope to get a little bit more into the Canadian Action Party later, but for the moment, let's get into the press release that you released on May 24th about
right.
the no-fly list, which is going to
right.
be implemented in Canada on June 18th. Could
right.
you talk a little bit about the no-fly list? What is it? When is it
well,
going to take
it's
place?
It's a list of names of human beings that, in this case, would be Canadians, that somebody, we don't know who exactly the somebody is, decides is a risk, terrorist risk, and therefore is not going to be permitted to get on a plane and fly in or out of Canada. And that all flows from the event, the 9/11 event in New York City in September 2001. The whole terrorist, anti-terrorist business, which is it's another whole thing we talk about, fundamental understanding what's really what's going on. So the no-fly list is a mechanism that's a particular instrument in the globalists in their direction of control and power over all of us, and are using the governments. The governments are participating with those globalists to create a state, really, a situation that is undemocratic and unconstitutional, and getting away with it because they do it under the guise of security and the necessity for the protection of the country, without telling us and really explaining what's going on. Now, the no-fly list in the United States has been in existence for a couple of years already. And the thing for people to understand is that everything that they do in the United States is going to happen in Canada, and the no-fly list is just an example of how it comes here a couple of years later. The reason everything is going to be done here that's done in the United States is that our, under a Liberal government, Prime Minister in 2005, Paul Martin, signed a smart border, signed a Security and Prosperity Partnership Agreement, and going back before that to December of 2001, John Manley, who was the Deputy Prime Minister at the time of Canada, Liberal, signed a document called Smart Border Declaration with the Tom Ridge, who was then the Homeland Security Chief in the United States, that basically promised to do this, to bring in a no-fly list.
Mm. Okay, yeah. Can you just break down that document for us? What is the Smart Border Declaration?
I'm sorry?
Could you just break that down for us? What is the Smart Border Declaration, and what did it state exactly in terms of creating an
The Smart Border Declaration is a list of terms that John Manley and Tom Ridge agreed would be the kinds of things that would be a good thing to do, and to secure the borders, to make North America safe. And I put all that in quotation marks. And it included matters like integrating our borders, which they've done so much already. If you try to go across the line, or you go fly in any airport, you see our security people all with this. If you look at the things on there, the labels on their shirt, they're all joined with the U.S. They promised to do things like bring in identification papers, where everything, all our information, all our personal information, our data, our eye prints, our fingerprints, our face prints, will all be put in a driver's license, or maybe on a passport. Exactly which way they're going to do it, we don't know yet in Canada. They're doing it with licenses and driver's licenses in the United States. Tracking devices on cars. These things are already happening. You go in certain highways in Ontario, for instance, like the big one that was sold, was privatized, and in order to drive on that, there are machines that track the cars as they go through, and a lot of vehicles can't even get on there unless they've got this I forget what the exact device is. It's some kind of a transponder. The tracking devices, the RFID, as I said, the initials for it, identifiers, again, tracking devices, are promised that they're going to be bringing in. Many promises, other terms that deal with the airports, with ferries, with borders, with matters that deal with business, trying to make things easier to go back and forth in terms of business. I just don't happen to have the list in front of me, but people can go to our website, the Canadian Action Party website, www.canadianactionparty.ca, and right on the home page there's an article that I wrote called "A Metamorphosis and Sabotage of Canada." If they look in there, in that article, I refer to the Smart Border Declaration and lay out some of the terms of that. And as a matter of fact, if they even Google Smart Border Declaration, they might be able to bring it up. A lot of these are government documents that have been, they removed them. They're not so easy to find. But all the information I've got in that article of mine have come from either our own government documents or U.S. Government documents. And, I mean, it, December 2001, Smart Border Declaration was signed by John Manley and Tom Ridge. And it's a formidable document that has, that lays out as a groundwork for cementing, with the first stage of the formal integration of Canada into the United States. They don't call it that, of course, but the thing to understand about the whole unification process is everything is being done piecemeal, deliberately. So on its own, it can maybe look kind of good, like someone say, well, gee, sure, as far as there's no pilot is concerned, isn't it a good thing to have the bad guys identified and they don't let them on planes? Well, no, it's not a good thing, because how do you identify? How do you target this person? And you see, the thing about the no-fly list, you can't find out if our name is on there. You're only going to find out when you go to the airport and you try to fly, and then the computer tells the airport people you're on this list and they don't let you on. And then you're not going to be allowed to fly. And in the States, experience already that's been happening there, I mean, children, babies have not ended up on the list because their name happened to be similar to some other name of somebody that somebody decided or defined as being a potential problem. Ted Kennedy was on the list, and he had a hell of a time getting off. You see, these are unelected bureaucrats who are operating the system, but the insidious thing is that we don't know how they choose the names. We don't know whether our name is going to get on there, and there's no easy process of getting off. What they do with all of this anti-terrorist stuff is say, well, you can go to the courts, you can do this and you can do that. Well, it's not so easy for an ordinary person to have to go through the courts. And anyway, why should we? I should stop and let you ask me another question.
Transport Canada is setting up a new office to appeal the no-fly list, inclusion on the no-fly list. But
yes.
I'm wondering about what you think that the role of that office is going to be, and whether it's going to be a legislative nightmare to get your name off the list.
It's going to be a nightmare, I can tell you right now. As I said to you at the beginning, I'm a lawyer by a profession, and I was a practicing lawyer in the courts. I did a lot of work as an advocate. That's what I was. I was an advocate. I was the kind of lawyer that goes to court and fights for people. And I know how difficult it is when you have to be put through any kind of a process to try to defend yourself or to justify yourself or to deal with an issue. It's cumbersome, it's expensive, and it's not something that we should need to do. We live in a country that prides itself on being democratic. We live in a country that has built-in rights and freedom guaranteed in our charter. Freedom of movement is a fundamental right in this country. Freedom to move from province to province is a fundamental right in this country. It's a fundamental violation of those rights to have a no-fly list to be operative in this country that in effect does violate that fundamental right of movement, freedom of movement. To be in a democracy, to be free, means you're fundamentally free to move. And it's just wrong. Absolutely wrong. Wrong, unacceptable, inexcusable, and harmful to the interest of the ordinary citizen to have that kind of a practice functioning. And it's not acceptable. And every citizen should just rise up and say, I don't care what excuses or what justifications or what mechanisms you say you're going to put in place to get me up. Why should I have to, after the fact, somebody puts my name on there and then puts me to the expense and the difficulty of trying to get myself off? That's, again, a fundamental violation of the kind of law that we've had in this country. We're in this country, we have a tradition of law that says we are innocent until we're proven guilty. It's not that we have to prove our innocence, it's that the state has to prove our guilt. And this kind of a no-fly list basically says, you're guilty, we put you on the name, and if you want off, you have to prove you're innocent. That's wrong. 100% wrong. 100% fly in the face of centuries and centuries of legal precedent and practice and entitlement in this country.
What do you say to the people who say that extra security at the expense of personal liberty is just the price we have to pay in the post-9/11 world?
That extra security is justified at the expense of personal liberty, is that what you said?
Yes.
I don't accept that at all. That's an Orwellian form of doublespeak. It's like, you know, there's one of these documentaries that was dealing with the 9/11 matter, and there's a documentary, they were interviewing a woman from England, and poor thing, you know, she said, oh, yeah, I know, I have to give up my liberty in order to be free. You see, and so her mind has been all twisted, and that's the kind of logic that's put out to all of us that our minds are screwed up by the arguments and the presentations that are put to us to justify the intrusion of our liberties and the destruction of our liberties. It's just not acceptable. Absolutely is not acceptable. I don't accept that doublespeak. I think it's just outrageous that we're put into a position where we even have to be talking about this. This should be just a no-brainer. You don't do that. You have to, and that's again speaks to the issue, though, of the whole 9/11 incident, and the amount of evidence that's coming out now that's so overwhelmingly compelling that that incident did not happen the way it's the official story presents it, and yet it was that incident that is being used to justify putting this no-fly list on us. It's just not right.
Okay, and earlier you were talking about the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Could you speak a little bit more to the initiatives in that SPP document?
Well, all right, that is an agreement that was entered between Canada's Prime Minister Paul Martin, Liberal, George Bush, United States President, and Vicente Fox from Mexico in April or March, I think it was, of 2005. And these three leaders of these three countries agreed to work towards the integration of North America, of these three countries, of our three countries, into a unified functioning region. And the agreement that they had flows from the demands of the chief executive officers of the most senior and influential, most powerful banking institutions, other kinds of corporate institutions that function in the United States and Mexico and Canada, mostly in the United States. There's the Council of Foreign Relations in the United States, the Canadian Council of Chief Executives in Canada, and then there's another similar body in Mexico. Behind the scenes have been around for a long time, and we're responsible for delivering us the free trade agreement and the NAFTA, and they've been putting pressure on our political people forever. And this Security and Prosperity Partnership Agreement basically is just a rubber stamping by the three political leaders of the agenda of a financial corporate elite that functions in North America. And again, that's a document. I refer to that document in that article of mine called The Metamorphosis and Sabotage of Canada by Our Own Government. It's on our website. People should go to that. It's a long article, but it's well documented with, again, sources taken right from our government site, from Council of Foreign Relations site, from the Canadian Council of Chief Executives site, from the U.S. government site. And this material is all information is available. That's what they'll say. Well, we're not doing this in secret. It's all there. Well, yeah, but how many ordinary people are going to sit around on their computer or Googling and trying to find and extract this information and deal with it? And then, actually, sometimes the stuff disappears after you found it. It doesn't stay out on the internet for very long, out on the website for forever. So what we have here operating right now is the leaders of these three countries working towards eliminating the nations, the three separate nations, and eliminating the sovereignty of the three separate nations. They will deny that, and they, for a while, as a matter of fact, they used to say, well, we didn't do it. You're making all that up. It's not happening. Now they're admitting it. But now they're saying, because in the United States there's a lot of pressure, more pressure happening in the United States about this than is happening here. And the argument that's being made is, well, it's not a treaty because they didn't sign it, and yet the documents I have and press releases that were made at the time say that Paul Martin and Vincent Fox and George Bush signed this Security and Prosperity Agreement. But they try to use semantics and words and say, well, it's not really an agreement. It's not really an international treaty because we didn't sign it. We didn't do this and that and the other thing. And yet the reality is the prep of implementation is in process big time. And this is a bad thing, the harmful thing for us. It's the same thing as with the European Union. The integration, there's an agenda for this integration, but their deliberate intention, and they openly say that the implementation is to be done piece by piece, bit by bit. And that way, nobody really knows what's happening to them, and it seems inconsequential. It doesn't seem like that big a deal, or it might seem in this particular corner this is kind of a good thing to do, to put the whole package together, and it's a very bad thing, and it's a very different thing than they pretend it is. In fact, it is the destruction of three nations, turning us into entities. We'll probably still have three names. We'll probably still be Canada, a United States, and a Mexico, but the powers that the elected people will have will be so dramatic. They will have no powers in the areas of significance like defense and trade and finance and international affairs. It'll all be done by the this unelected corporate body of the, that is the administrative structure of the Security and Prosperity Partnership Agreement and the agenda of the North American Union.
What is the reaction you're getting from the general public when you talk about the SPP and the North American Union?
Well, you'd be surprised at how many people are quite informed now already, which is good news. But a lot of people, of course, just look at you and say, well, you're just a nutbag. You're a nutcase. You're making all that stuff up. This is can't be possibly happening. Our government wouldn't do that to us. That's just crazy talk. You know, you're just full of conspiracy theories. And I would feel a lot more comfortable if that were the truth. The reality is that's not. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's something that's happening, and it's an agenda that I'm very satisfied from my work is happening, and even for me to even have to say that this is happening, it's just, and these guys just laugh at us because they're doing this stuff to us under our very noses, and the public doesn't want to believe these things are happening. That is a reality, and yet a lot of other people will say, you know, I've kind of always known this kind of stuff was happening. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but I'm really glad that you're there and that you're talking about it and that you're closing this stuff. And now I feel better because now I know I'm not alone. I'm not just crazy myself because that's the view that I had and that I was worrying about. Now you're telling me I was right all along. And so, well, at least I'm glad there's somebody there that's on a political front that's at least speaking about it and trying to get information out and is saying, well, there's a vehicle for me to go to try to save myself and to save my country.
So what do you think of the Ron Paul revolution taking place south of the border?
I think that's a good thing. That's a reason for hope. It means there's a lot of us, people that are questioning and don't want this new system they're imposing on us. They're telling us it's the only way and is the way and the right way and that we're going to get it whether we like it or not. And there's nothing we can do about it. There are a lot of other people, human beings, citizens are gathering together and saying, no, I don't think so. I'm not just going to take this lying down. And it's encouraging, it's hopeful, because when you look at this stuff, it's quite overwhelming, actually, when you see the extent of the implementation already of the integration is quite well advanced. And when you look and you look at it and realize the extent of power that we're dealing with, that's there to impose on us a different system than what we have that take away our democracy and our constitutional rights, it can be quite discouraging and it can be quite debilitating, and it can drive you crazy if not sick. So it's very important for people to come together and to hear about other good things that are happening somewhere and to know there are some other voices. And it's a real disgrace in Canada that there is only this little voice of ours that's dealing with these issues. None of the other parties will touch this stuff, and yet it's so fundamental and so profound. It just speaks to, again, to the level of control and power that's coming down. That all the other parties are submitting to, and it's very, very worrisome. So when you see a groundswell of movement that's really developing in the States, that's positive, and that will help us. And it's funny though, when I talk and I get interviewed by programs in the United States, they look at our website and they think, oh God, they know that's a very powerful website, and you're really saying strong stuff, and you're very courageous, and you're really doing all these things that no one else down here is saying. And so they think that the Canadians are really strong and they're really standing up, when in fact we don't represent the massive numbers of Canadians. Most of them don't even know we exist. So what has to happen and what is happening is that the existence of this party with this voice is getting some exposure by those other alternative programs in the States who are talking about it. But the point is, to your question, it's a very encouraging thing. There are many, many people in Canada who are very worried, very upset, and don't want this regime change. as there are in the United States, and we are connecting, and that means to me we're in a war, but there's power amongst ourselves for us to defend ourselves and to face this bully and this brute.
Okay. I've had some comments from some of my listeners that they'd like to help with the Canadian Action Party but are of limited financial means. What can people do to help the Canadian Action Party in its fight?
Well, join, for one thing, and so that they're with us. They can go to our website and join right there, or they can write to us, and it only costs $10 to join, and so that's just part of the mass of people that are working being together. One of the things we need to do, you know, people there's information that we have, for instance, like a video that has been done where I do a speech. They can get that video, they can take it, like the 9/11 Truth Movement does. People will take these DVDs and they hand them out, and they make extra copies of them and they pass them around to their friends, and so that's how the movement spreads and the information spreads. We're asking people to do that with this DVD. It happens to be quite a good one. It was very well technically produced, and it's been very well received, and it gets the message out strong. And so that's something that they can do. They can look at it themselves to inform themselves and help. I hope it has a message on there that can make people feel, give them some courage, and to alleviate their own fear. Because when you really know what's going on, it, as I said before, it's very overwhelming, and a lot of people end up being quite afraid. So it's something they can do for themselves, and then they can show it to other friends and help to get information out to other people, because as from a previous question you said, it's quite true. A lot of people don't know a thing about this, and they don't want to believe it. And so I think this video done by me on the North American Union it's only an hour long, and it seems to be something. It's very, people seem to like it. It seems to express things in ways that people can understand. So that's something they can do. The big thing is for people just to talk to their own neighbors, talk to their friends, get information out, let people know, and encourage them to go to our website just to be an active recruit in that kind of a way. And if they don't, of course, we always need money. But the big thing is to be connected. The big thing is for us to create an army of concerned citizens who are going to stand together as a force. And doesn't take money to do that or be a force. Just become a member, be with us.
And on that note, Ms. Vogel, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.